Thank you, everybody. Thank you. I appreciate that. Susan, thank you for the nice introduction. Susan and I have worked with each other a number of years, and I understand that you're a couple of years away from becoming the president. So I knew you were a wise bunch. So I thought I'd just get right into it today. Your timing could not be more perfect. Absolutely could not be more perfect. Here you are out here for this event. You're right in the middle of Senate markup on the Farm Bill and House markup on the Farm Bill. Yesterday it was announced that the next bill we will go to will be the Farm Bill. And I think the hope is that on the Senate side, we'll get a Farm Bill done next week, which is admittedly ambitious, but I think that's the hope. Here's what I would expect, although I have no inside information or special crystal ball. My expectation is that the majority leader, Senator Reid, will probably file for cloture on the Farm Bill that was passed out of committee yesterday, probably do that today. The reason why he would do that is to set that up probably for the first vote next week. That would be my thought. That way it'll be ready for first vote to proceed to the bill, and then we go through what we went through last time, which hopefully will be a lot of debate and amendments. Here's where we're at. You saw the vote yesterday. The Farm Bill got a sufficient number of votes to move forward. As I said in my opening statement, there are some things about this Farm Bill that I do like. As you know, when I was Secretary of Agriculture, I advocated for tighter payment limits. This bill probably goes as far as any bill has gone in that area, so I think that's good. When we were doing the Farm Bill listening sessions, many of you were moderators for me, and I appreciated that. One of the things we heard from producers was that the conservation title was unnecessarily complicated. Producers like conservation, ranchers like conservation, the hook and bullet people like conservation. You can build a tremendous amount of support for the conservation title. But pretty much everybody we talked to said, my goodness, this is complicated. It is complicated. There would be times at the USDA where we would confuse ourselves as to what we were doing under the conservation title. You may find that surprising, but it's true. So it just occurred to me that we needed to do some things to simplify it. If you go back to the document we put out back then, we made some recommendations on how we could have a better, more streamlined, to make more coherent conservation title. Many of those changes are now being incorporated in the Farm Bill or something close to it. So I feel good about that. You know, that debate's been going on for quite a few years now, and I think we're making progress, and hopefully we'll end up with a better conservation title. But Title I is always a debate, and it's always a bit controversial. But let me, if I might, start out before I dig into Title I with maybe a kind of a macro picture here. We've been running around our states over the past months kind of bragging about how our Farm Bill proposal saves $24 billion, that we've stepped up, we're saving money, and the rest of the federal government, if they'd only do what we'd do, then the world would be better. The reality is we have fallen short on that. I don't think we can go out there and say our Farm Bill is saving $24 billion. Here's why. The first thing that is problematic in terms of that score is that we're trying to take credit for the sequester again. You know, that was done in 2011. It is the law of the land, and we're saying, well, let's take credit for that in this proposed Farm Bill. That seems like double counting to me. The second thing is that there's a piece of this. In fact, the commodity title payments, the last payment is made outside the scoring window. Not because that's the way it should be done. That's not the way it should be done. But if you take the payments outside the window, the Farm Bill necessarily looks cheaper than it is. you're going to make those payments, right? I mean, there's no doubt about it. And if you just let the law run its course, you would make those payments within the scoring time frame. Well, you add all of that up, and we probably have a farm bill that actually saves about $14 billion, $15 billion. Then there's some other pieces to this that I have to tell you philosophically are just, I must admit, quite painful for me to see coming back. And let me talk, if I might, a little bit about that. I think we can all look back to the day I became Secretary of Agriculture, and from a price standpoint for commodities, it was a very difficult time. I'm going to guess if you checked the date I was sworn in, the price of corn was roughly $2, maybe a little better, maybe a little worse. You could check soybeans and on and on. And as Secretary of Agriculture, it was tough to figure out how we were going to pull agriculture through that. Raising $2 corn doesn't have much of a future. You'll go broke doing that. I could say the same thing about other commodities. So what was happening is exactly what you would anticipate. The countercyclical program was kicking in. You had direct payments. You had the marketing loan program. You had target prices. You had basically the government micromanaging agriculture. My dream was that we would move beyond that day. A little different time. I remember many senators coming to me after I was sworn in and people at USDA and saying, you know, one of the things that we like about what you are doing is that you understand you've got to create a greater market for the products that we produce. Well, that's foreign trade. That's a piece of it. Ethanol was a piece of it. Whether you like ethanol or don't like ethanol, the reality is that it created a market, and it started to shift some decisions out there. But the marketplace was demanding that, and not the government programs. Well, ladies and gentlemen, no doubt about it, over the last years, including these years with Secretary Vilsack as Secretary of Agriculture, we've had some remarkable years. My goodness, debt is being paid down. You'd have to really stretch to find a time when the balance sheet was better than it is now. Farmers are tending to business. You know, I talk to bankers, and bankers say, you know, we're not so much loaning on agriculture as providing bridge loans now. Because they have the economic wherewithal in many cases to put the crop in and accept more and more of their risk. Why? Because, again, good managers are tending to business. Commodity prices have been strong, and you kind of tick down through every category, and a lot of things are happening. We've got a pretty good tax policy for agriculture. We've now got a pretty good estate tax policy in place. And so piece by piece, we've been kind of setting the stage, the foundation, if you will, for agriculture to be a more market-based enterprise than it was just 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago. So what do we do in response to that? We raise target prices. Whoa, wait a second here. Raise target prices? That's kind of what we did in the 1980s. That's kind of the kind of agriculture that basically sustained agriculture when there wasn't these other things going on. So I looked at it 2 years ago, and I said a couple of things to the producers back in Nebraska. I said, number one, direct payments are going to go away, because I don't think we can make a sustainable argument that direct payments should be made in this kind of atmosphere. It won't be well received, and at the end of the day, we would never get the votes to get it done. Interestingly enough, my producers were absolutely good with it. I had very, very little pushback on that, and I was saying that 2 years ago. The other thing I said to them is this is going to be a very lean farm bill. Remember I said the budget will define what this farm bill is all about? Well, producers came back to me and they basically said in Nebraska, look, Mike, crop insurance has turned out to be a program that we believe, with the other tools available, we can manage our risk in a way that we can get through the good times and the bad times, and we just feel that what we want you to do is just maintain the current crop insurance program. Those were my marching orders as a senator from Nebraska. Farmers did not ask me to raise target prices. They've moved beyond target prices. They don't want to go back to that day. They don't want to go back to the day of how good is the government program and is the government program going to pay the bills. That's the last thing in the world that they want to go back to. They want a risk management program that is market-based. They want me to do everything I can to create markets for the products that they can create. They want me to be as forceful as I can in selling our products in other parts of the world, and that really is a message. So I just worry that what we did yesterday in the Senate Ag Committee is just a step in the wrong direction. It's a step not beyond 2013. It is a step more toward 1980 and farm policy back then. Well, at the end of the day, I worry that we start working our way back to where we were before, and that is low prices, government programs, and I just don't think it serves agriculture in the long term. So my hope is that we'll make some progress there. I want to mention one last area, although there's a lot of things that I could talk about in the bill, but this is an important area too. We've all watched the growth in the nutrition programs in agriculture. You know, when you were covering me as secretary, the story you would write would be that the nutrition programs are now over half the USDA budget. In fact, they'd be about 60% back then. Well, the story that you would write today is that they're closing in on 80%. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not heartless. If somebody needs food, I want to do that. After all, we in Nebraska are in the food business, not only in terms of the raising of food, but in the production, the processing. I mean, we try to do it all in Nebraska, and we think that's very, very important. But at the end of the day, I want to make sure that we don't have a situation where we're expanding the program with people that really aren't qualified to be in the program. So yesterday I ran an amendment. It would have saved about $11 billion, and it would have taken nobody off the program that's entitled to receive it. It basically said, let's not do categorical eligibility. And basically, as you know, that's a program where if you sign up for this, you automatically get into the SNAP program or the food stamp program. Now, that did not have enough votes. We ended up with modifications that will impact the nutrition title to the tune of about $4 billion. I just think in order to get a bill with the House, it's going to have to be north of that. I think it's going to have to be quite a bit north of the $4 billion. What the magic number is will probably be determined in conference. I don't think anybody could give you great information on what that magic number is, but it's going to be more than the $4 billion that the Senate was talking about. With that, those are the things I wanted to at least touch on, and I'd be happy to take your questions.
Yes, Chuck Brown with AgWire.com. Can you comment on the confirmation process for
Gina McCarthy? Yes. The confirmation process for Gina McCarthy is the rules provide, the rules of that committee and the Senate provide that you have to have, I think, at least two Republicans or two members of the minority party in the room. They are not satisfied, the members of the EPW committee, with the response. You're going to find this shocking, but the EPA, according to them, has not been exactly forthcoming with information. Now, that's probably your headline today. I'm saying that facetiously, obviously. I'm still waiting for them to tell me what their aerial surveillance program is. So the Republicans, the minority, said, look, until we get the information we've requested, we're just not going to confirm her. We're not going to send anybody into the room. I'm going to guess that at some point the chair will try to move this nomination to the floor, and then we'll see what happens next. So I don't think her confirmation is a foregone conclusion. Some might have argued that a few weeks ago, but I don't think that's the case. Gina McCarthy troubles me a great deal. Lisa Jackson was very difficult to work with. I understand a difference in philosophy. The Obama administration epitomizes that. They're probably not going to appoint people that I'm going to bless. You know, the president doesn't ask me, who do I put at Treasury, Mike? But on the other hand, I expect some degree of cooperation. This group is the most uncooperative bunch in the federal government. They're very difficult, and I hate to see that continued.
On the not really declared with what was in the bill that you passed yesterday, on the Prop change, you mentioned a means test. Is there a means test now and payment limits applied to that?
There is, Ben, you're going to have to help me on this. There's an AGI limit in the new bill that came out of the Senate yesterday. And that applies to the entirety of the title, right?
Commodity
title. Crop insurance? No AGI limit on crop insurance. So that's how it works. Commodities, all commodity payments would have that limit. Here's my prediction, and again, my crystal ball is probably about as good as anybody's in the room. I think this administration is limping along at this point. You know, they had those first couple of years where they had 60 in the Senate, they had overwhelming majority of the House, they could pass anything they could get their side to agree upon, and that's how you got health care and Dodd-Frank and on and on. Voters changed that. House went Republican. Senate was more closely divided, continues to be that. You're not going to pass that kind of legislation. So then they turned to the regulatory effort, and you could just see everybody amped up their regulatory effort. But now, you know, you've got this AP scandal, trying to get records on conversations people like you would have, reporters, you know. Talk about a chilling impact on the First Amendment. You've got Kathleen Sebelius out there raising money. Man, if there was one rule in the secretary's handbook from day one, don't raise money from people you regulate. Probably shouldn't be raising money anyway in that job. So what she was thinking, I don't know. You've got Benghazi and everything situated around that. You've got the IRS. And I think this group is now just in a state of shock. And I just think it's going to be harder and harder for them to do the things they need to do. These things have an impact on the day-to-day operations. So this administration is at risk of limping to the end and literally spending their time dealing with all these problems that they've created. It's not like bad Republicans or bad reporters have not been nice to them. This is self-inflicted.
With regard to trade, Trans-Pacific Partnership, do you believe in it? What's been our experience with the European Union and talk of a free trade deal between the two, especially now as a challenger at
home? Here's what I would say about the partnership, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I believe in it. I think it's good. But here's a president that has not asked for a TPA, Trade Promotion Authority. How do you get this done? And so I look at it. I think there's talks going on. I think there's probably an effort that's sincere by some members of the administration to get this done. But how do you get it to the finish line? You would think the first thing he would do is say, I need TPA. That's how you negotiate these deals, because countries are reluctant to deal with you if at the end of the day they lay all their cards on the table and every senator, every House member can amend the deal. And so I just think I just don't see the building blocks being put in place to get there, although I've got no criticism of the need to do something in this arena, in the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Here's what I would say about the European Union. As a governor, I traveled all over the world for trade purposes. As a secretary, I traveled all over the world. As a governor, I would tell you I didn't see much future in the markets in Europe. Number one, they've got a population issue. Their population is static. Number two, so many of the European countries are in recession. Number three, they just like a style of agriculture that, quite honestly, is vastly different than ours. Plus, they're very hard to deal with. They just are. You know, it was kind of every day there was kind of a new thing that caused them to believe they just could not buy our beef or our whatever. And it might be GMOs, it might be hormones in beef, it just kind of went on and on and on. So won't you go to a part of the world where you're seeing economic growth and openness to working with the United States on these issues, etc.? So I don't understand that one. I must admit, I don't understand it, and I don't think the European Union is going to give up on these issues, which are very, very significant issues in terms of a trading relationship between our countries. So I'll be surprised if that one goes very far. I'll be very surprised. And if they don't get TPA, I wonder how far the Trans-Pacific Partnership will go. Well, I'm a believer in ethanol. Now, my cattle industry in Nebraska is as positive as my relationship is. They don't share the same focus on this as Mike Johans does. Here's something I would share with you, though. On a regular basis in my Senate office, we bring in some people that I worked with at the USDA, and we try to do it. Kind of an analysis of where we think we're at in terms of farm income, other parts of the world, crop production, prices, that sort of thing. Kind of some of the same things I did as Secretary of Agriculture. If you take ethanol out of the equation, then obviously you've got a lot of corn that needs a market. We need countries like China, et cetera, to boost that up. But I don't see any reason why you would want to take ethanol out of the equation. Now, I will also say to the ethanol people what I've been saying for years and years. I said this as governor when I was chair of the Governor's Ethanol Coalition. The sign of success for me is when the ethanol industry operates independently of any kind of government program, and it's out there standing on its own 2 feet. I believe we can get there. I believe we will get there. Having said that, I just think it's way too early to be talking about anything other than the mandate. That's important to have that in place. To those people in the pork industry, poultry, beef, whatever, who are saying, yeah, but Mike, geez, you know, $6 corn, $7 corn is got a downside to it for my industry. Here's what I would say. If we get a better year weather-wise, if we get moisture, If we can get the crop in, because we're behind, you know, I was looking just this week at the numbers in our state, and we need a couple of weeks here where the sun shines and we get a nice little breeze and dry things out and let's go, and we can get there. Yeah, keep your fingers crossed. You put all of those things together and you begin to realize that with the acres planted, a reasonable projection on yield, and you could have much cheaper corn than you have today. Now, here's what I'd say. Next December, when none of those things happen and corn is still $6, $7 a bushel, you can come back and tell me that, and I'll eat my words. If I was that good at projecting these things, I'd be doing that for a living instead of what I'm doing. None of us really are. But having said that, you put the pieces together, a better year, get that planting done, and all of a sudden you're going to begin to see that the market will find some equilibrium here. And that's the nature of it. And that's why I say over and over again, let's farm for the market. Let's protect risk. Let's be good risk managers. Let's offer some assistance in doing that here in Washington. But let farmers do what they do very, very well, and that's production.
Yeah. When you were Secretary of Agriculture, agriculture was going through probably one of the worst economic stretches. At the same time, the other United States economy was starting to really build steam. Today, we're looking at a totally different scenario. Agriculture in the last two or three years has built that agriculture steam as well, providing economic growth in the United States. The rest of it is slumping. As you look at the farm bill that's come out of the Senate Ag Committee, do you feel like protections are in place for agriculture over the next 5 years? Should interest rates start to move, commodity and livestock prices begin to slump to protect us against what happened in your view?
Here's what I would say about the livestock market. Keep in mind that the meat industry has not had the rock and roll times that some of, boy, I tell you, if you're in the cow-calf, fat cattle, et cetera, boy, those guys, they've been gasping for air. It has not been the go-go economy that we've seen. So actually, there's been a pretty significant disparity and profitability in giving sectors of the agriculture. Because of the drought, herds got culled, prices went down, but the pork industry and the poultry industry have also had a rough go of it. So let's factor that in. I still believe, though, that the model that works best is a crop insurance model, revenue-based, disaster-based, giving the producer the option of buying the level of crop insurance that they want. They can insure up to 85%. As you know, with the ARC program, there'll be an additional feature there. The South says, well, Mike, that doesn't work as well for us. All I can say is let's try to figure out a way how it does work for the South. Because I just think the whole idea of target price is going to be harder and harder to sustain and explain in today's world. But I believe the answer to your question is yes. Now, here's the hard part of this is these programs don't really offer that kind of assistance into the meat industry. But having said that, by and large, they come in and say, look, We have always produced for the marketplace. We want to continue to do that. Actually, we want less government interference, not more. But some of our guys in Nebraska are also planting corn while they're feeding cattle or hogs or whatever. So you get a mix and a balance here. Final thing I would say, there is no more sophisticated bunch out there than the people that are in agriculture today. The old-timers like myself, they got weathered in the 80s, right? If they survived the 80s, they had something going. this new generation, they understand risk management tools. You know, I visited so many farms where there would be dad, and then there would be a daughter and maybe two sons or whatever the combination was. Well, this one would do the crop work. This one would do the livestock work. This one would be selling the stuff they produce. They had the risk management background. It's just, I think it's just a remarkably different world, and it's a joy to see. I mean, that's why I don't want government to interfere with what's going on out there. I just, for a kid who grew up on 160 acres, man, this is a dream come true. This is remarkable. And yet there's a place for other kinds of agriculture. Organics have a place. You know, look at the success they've had. And I could go right on through agriculture. So I do think that tools are in place, but not perfect. But we should look at fixing those tools versus getting uneasy and going back to the 1980s. Yes?
Senator, yes.
Yeah, well, thank you. I take that as a nice compliment. Here's what goes into it. Stephanie and I started this in 1981. I kicked off a campaign for county commissioner. We met as county commissioner. She was a fellow county commissioner. When I got elected, the board, county board in Lancaster County, was expanded from 3 to 5 members, and she was appointed. We worked together 4 years, and we ended up getting married. And when she said, I do, she probably didn't realize it, but she was saying, I do agree to run a whole lot of campaigns. And there's been a bunch. I think there were 16 primary and general elections over those years. There was 8 different offices, or 8 offices between the two of us. Our faith is very important to us. Our relationship with each other is very important to us. We have 5 grandkids. And we just decided that it was time to turn the page. The other thing, we love our state. Nebraskans have been so good. They backed us when nobody believed I could ever be the governor. And I just never wanted to stay to a point of people saying, can't we ever get rid of this guy? Well, I could almost design the campaign, you know, against me, but it didn't look like we didn't see opposition at this stage. But that wasn't the driving force. It was faith in family, in each other, and just a time for a quieter portion of our life. So that's what really drove it as much as anything. So. Yeah, you know, here's what I would say about the Humane Society. As secretary, I was always willing to partner with Wayne and members of the Humane Society on the appropriate treatment of puppies and kittens. And it was during my tenure that the prosecution of Michael Vick occurred, although that was an investigation that, quite honestly, was being directed by very capable people at the USDA. It wasn't being directed out of the secretary's office. I have no criticism of that whatsoever in that effort. My concern is that there is a group of people, whoever they are, that are trying to champion a different kind of agriculture than what exists in the United States. And this, the most recent was they were going to take this poultry agreement and embody it in the Farm Bill. So what's the net effect of that precedent? The net effect of that precedent is you put the force and power of the federal government behind the size of a chicken cage. And it's kind of like, whoa, where does this stop? You know, you can make a an argument that, look, we want clean streams and clean air, and so there should be involvement here. But you literally get into a situation where does it end? Now, I will tell you in my own experience, when we brought the farrowing, I can remember putting the farrowing crates together as a little kid on my dad's farm. There were a dozen of them. We would farrow about a dozen sows, you know. Here's what I would tell you about that. You know what? We thought that was the humane thing to do. Why? Because in an open pen, they lay on the piglets. They're cannibalistic. The mother will eat the baby pig. Well, you could stop that by a closer confinement. We didn't see that as abusive at all. We saw that as a giant step forward. And like I said, I can remember the day we put those crates together and we looked at those dozen crates and we were so proud of what we had done, you know. And now somebody comes in who has no background and experience in agriculture and they want us to adopt their standards and force those standards on production agriculture in the meat industry. And I'm just saying hold everything. Now, last thing I'd say here. If the poultry people want to reach an agreement with the Humane Society, you know what? It's a free world. They don't have to come to Mike Johansen and say, Mike, do you agree with us on this? Should we do it? They can ask my advice, and I'll give it to them, but quite honestly, they're free to do it. Where I drew the line is asking me to cast my vote to embody that kind of restriction in federal legislation, and I just think it goes too far to start setting national standards on that kind of thing, and I just think it has dire consequences for the industry. So a few weeks ago, this came to my attention. I pushed back. I think I irritated the poultry people, but quite honestly, I feel very strongly this was the right thing to do. We shouldn't be gumming up a farm bill with these kinds of standards in federal legislation. So I'm glad it's not there, and we'll try to make sure it doesn't get there as we move it through the House or move it through the Senate and the House.